Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Welcome to the Coach Steve Clark Show, where he will encourage, inspire, and equip coaches, players, and parents who will in turn motivate and help others to promote the great game of tennis, foster sportsmanship, and develop greater players and people. Thanks for joining us, and here's your host, Steve Clark.
Hello everyone, this is Steve Clark, and thanks so much for tuning in the show. Today, as usual, I have a great friend and coaching colleague with me, but what we're going to be talking about today is the mental side of tennis, and today I have Coach Alan Fox, PhD, with me, but let me introduce him to you all first before we get started. Coach, are you there?
I'm here.
That's great. So folks... All ears, and he's actually was just on court coaching a player, and let me go through some of Coach's background here. In 1961, he graduated from UCLA with a BA in physics. I guess back then they didn't have BSs, it was a BA, but then he went on to get a PhD in psychology from UCLA. As a player, he won the singles and the doubles in the NCAA. He was the UCLA Athlete of the Year. And there's another accolade that must have been back then, but it's pretty impressive. He was all University of California Athlete of the Year. That's over all the universities. So that's quite a distinguished accolade. In the pros, Coach was in 1962. He's winner of the U.S. National Hard Courts, and he was one of the top five men in the U.S. for 1961 to 1968. He's a three-time U.S. Davis Cup team member, quarter finalist in Wimbledon, Canadian national singles champion, and he was the champion of the Pacific Southwest singles in 1966. And to do that, he had to beat Roy Emerson, Fred Sauli, Tony Roach, and Manuel Santana. So that's pretty impressive. But later on, as he was coaching, he took over the Pepperdine team and he built that program. 10 consecutive top five NCAA finishes, two NCAA team finals. And he coached the likes of Brad Gilbert, good friend Glenn Michibata, Kelly Jones. And he's been involved with pros such as Dinara Safina and John McEnroe. In addition to all that, he does speaking, consulting. He's wrote numerous books, and one of which we're going to talk predominantly about today. And that's Tennis, Winning the Mental Game. And he does a lot of one-minute clinics on the Tennis Channel, if you haven't seen him. So and let me cap it off with this. He's a three-time Hall of Fame, and no wonder with all those accolades. He's a Hall of Fame member for the Southern California Tennis Association, the Intercollegiate Tennis Association, or the ITA, and UCLA. Well, Alan, welcome to the show, and my listeners are in for a treat. How are you today?
I'm fine. And thank you for that nice introduction. You got stuff that I haven't heard for a while. Anyway, thank you.
Yeah, it's well deserved. For those of you in all my coaching years, it was always a blast coaching against Alan. We say against, but it's with, because we're in the same path of trying to make great players and people. And Alan was always a treat to compete against. So, well, we're going to get in.
We even hit some balls.
Yeah, that's right.
I even played a little bit in the old days. You were pretty darn tough, I must say.
Well, we're going to talk about tennis, winning the mental match today. And as I do with all my books, my wife knows that I have to have a pen in my hand, and I converse with the author. Today, I actually get to do it audibly, but I write notes in books, and that's why I can't take library books out, because I end up writing in them, so I can't do that. So for all the juniors, parents, and coaches listening, this is going to be basically a discussion of his book, and I would encourage you to go buy the book, and you can get at that at just about anywhere. I guess Amazon and Tennis, the Warehouse, and places like that. Is that available on all those avenues?
Yeah, it's available there and on my website, AlanFoxTennis.net.
AlanFoxTennis.net.
Right, and also they can get it electronically on Kindle and iTunes. So, a lot of
okay,
ways
great.
To get it.
Yeah, if you want a hand copy like I need, because I like to write in them, and I'm more visual. I can remember exactly where something was. So, Alan, if you don't mind, a lot of times in bios or things when we listen to people or we read about them, we don't get this stuff about when they were juniors. So, for our juniors that might be listening and their parents that are coaching juniors, I was wondering if you might be able to give us a little hindsight. What was your junior experience like? Did you play a lot of different sports? Was it tennis only right away? What interest, other interests did you have? Anything that's about your junior experience?
Well, I have to admit, I was not a great athlete. I was a medium athlete. Tennis, to me, tennis was a sport that suited me. And for whatever reasons, I got good at tennis quickly. It came easy. I guess there was a certain hand-eye aspect of it that I was good at. So I started playing late, actually. I was almost 14 when I started. And it took in about a year and 4 months, I had gotten ranked nationally, maybe 35, I think. What saved me as a junior, I was a fanatic practicer. And for you kids that are looking to get good, it's somewhat of a simple strategy. I was going to hit more balls than anybody. And I was going to get technically sound. The other thing that saved me as a medium athlete was I would watch. In those days, they didn't have great coaches, so I would watch the best players, and then I would work on exactly what they were doing for months and months and months and hours every day. And so that's kind of what got me good, was just the repetitious hard work and concentration on technique, so that each stroke was about as well-formed as I could hit it. And then just the hours of practice. I had one other little advantage as a player, and that is in my day, this is the 60s, a lot of the best players slice their backhands or hit it flat. And for whatever reasons, I sort of understood to hit it with topspin. So I had a topspin backhand and a topspin forehand early, which was a big help against the net rushers of the time. So that was kind of it for the juniors. I was not great junior, but I was top 10 in the country by the end as a junior. And I did win the Southern California Juniors. So I was pretty good junior, not a great junior. And I just kept improving because I hit more balls than anybody else all the time. And so the improvement continued.
Well, that's
a late
good.
Bloomer.
Yeah. Well, before we get into the book, I want to kind of get personal. When you talk about the juniors, can you give us an example? So everybody else who isn't top 10 in the juniors and your regular club player out there, maybe, or some college guys, different levels. Can you give us an example of a good, the good, bad, and ugly when you played? Like maybe an example, hey, you remember, oh boy, did I lay an egg mentally on that one? Or maybe another example of somebody that you know, fell apart playing you, and what'd you do to them? Or maybe the good side of it. I don't know. Maybe give us an example of the good, bad, or the ugly.
Well, the bad was that I had several bads that hurt me at the play. I figured them out and then took steps to try to, you know, control the bad or make the bad not so bad. Some of the bad really never goes away, no matter what you do, and other parts of the bad can go away. And so my bad was I had a very bad temper since I was a fanatic. I didn't like it when things didn't go my way. And so I would get frustrated in the juniors and get angry. And so I lost a lot of matches getting angry. The other way I didn't lose them so much in the juniors choking. I didn't choke that much in the juniors, but I did choke later in the men's division. And I had to figure out ways to control that. That never went away totally. If I had to do all over again, you know, I think I could have been better at that. But that was a weakness. The good was sort of understanding the game, understanding strategy. I was very good and one other thing I was good at is I did understand that you want to break down your opponent over the long haul. And so when I started out the match, I was already working to kind of break my opponent down. Not by psyching him or talking, but by sort of trying to find a weakness and trying to grind it. Because I found that was the best way to win matches. Was actually you find a weak point in your opponent's game, whatever it is, something you can do better than they can do. And then you sort of keep working it. They try to get away from it and escape, figure a way out. They break down. And so that I understood. I mean, to me, it was a whole process. And I did understand the essence of competing. Emotional control I didn't get until later in my career. So that's a good. The ugly, I don't know, if, was there ugly? I loved the game. I loved all of it. I loved the competing. I guess I loved the practice at some level. I mean, I was good for 6 hours a day or more if I had a chance, even when I was playing tournaments. When I would play a tournament match, afterwards I'd go out and practice for the rest of the afternoon. So my theory at the time was, as soon as I leave the tennis court, I don't get any better.
So, I like it.
Yeah. So I didn't leave the tennis court unless I had to. Unless it was dark.
Right.
So I didn't realize at the time, by the way, that everybody didn't do that. it was sort of a miracle that I got as good as I got. I would think to myself, gee, I'm not that good an athlete. How can I beat these guys? I mean, why am I getting better than them? I didn't realize that they weren't practicing 6 hours a day.
Well, yeah. Well, Alan, let's maybe dive into the book here, because already, folks, for some of you who haven't read the book, some of the things he mentioned there, for example, it is possible to win a match when you don't have a high level of confidence. It is possible to win a match when, you know, if you look on paper, an opponent has a bunch of strengths, but all you need is one weakness. It is possible if you happen to choke to win a match. You know, and Alan talks about these things in the book. So I'm going to go, if you don't mind, Coach, I'd like to maybe go a little bit chapter by chapter. Maybe I can probe and then, you know, you can reflect on some of the thoughts there. And then, you know, depending on our time, I might, you know, skip a chapter or two. But obviously they got to get the book because we're just giving the tip of the iceberg version. And so does that sound good?
It sounds good. May I say something?
Yes.
This is just to you, really. But
I can't turn off to everybody listening, but go for it.
Yeah, it's to you. First, it's just interesting. You're spending a bit of time to promote my stuff, going out of your way to do it. And that's a very considerate what should I say? I don't know. It's very considerate. So I want to thank you, and forward we go.
Well, no, I appreciate that. No problem. Because when stuff's good, you want to promote it. And again, part of the show is, you know, since he brings that up, folks, one of the things about coaching and just the tennis world in general, particularly about coaching, is it's a brotherhood. But we want to, you know, we love the game, and we want the game to thrive. And, you know, I think it was Ben Franklin says, a lot gets done if nobody takes the credit. Well, you know, to me, if there's, you know, a great coaching colleague out there with some great thoughts and has written them down or can talk about them, then we should all benefit from them. So we all glean from each other. So the first chapter, Alan, you say, why do we want to win? You kind of talk about a few things in there. And I just wanted to put a couple items out there that you mentioned in there. You say two of them, and you can talk on them or if there's anything else. But it says, you say women and men compete differently. And then one of the other points in there, you say aggression and competition are linked to fear. And much of this book is about reducing it. So if you could maybe comment on those two things, you know, for people who coach men and women.
Okay. Well, overall, we're hardwired to want to win. I mean, people recognize at some level, a lot of people, that winning really doesn't matter in these recreational level matches or tournaments even. I mean, they're not that important. It's just a game. However, when you get into it, you want to win. It's natural. And we're wired that way because we're a social creature. Humans, like wolves or chimpanzees, and all social creatures have a hierarchy. You know, some individuals are ranked higher than others, and humans are like that. We have some sort of ranking, and it feels important because of just the emotional system wiring that that each of us want to be ranked high. We don't like to be behind other people. And so when you get into a tennis match, the ranking issue is at stake. And so if you lose, the opponent has somehow beaten you, has bested you, and you're inferior to that person. And that doesn't feel good. You want to be the superior one. It would have been hardwired in thousands of years ago because it would have survival value. In small groups that we were probably in, you know, 50,000, 40,000 years ago, the higher ranking individual, if food was scarce, was going to eat. And the low ranking ones were going to starve. And so it paid to want to be ranked high, and it paid to be ranked high. And if you didn't care what you were ranked, then you'd be ranked low because you wouldn't be willing to push and fight for it. And so you'd be low ranking, and your genes wouldn't be in the gene pool anymore. So that's what we're all sort of stuck with.
So Alan, I have a quick, I have a question. Are you familiar with the universal tennis rating? It's coming out, but it's you know, been a highly influential thing kind of going into college tennis. And anyways, I was curious if you had David Fish. I had last weekend, but it talks about a kind of like France. It's a rating as opposed to a ranking. And my question was, but we can move on. I was just curious if you knew how that affects the psyche, because there isn't a ranking. It's more of a rating area. And, you know, if you have a, you know, for example, you and I could both be, you know, let's say a 13 or something, 14 wish, then we would both be 14. So there's not necessarily this pecking order. It's just that we're striving to get better and compete. So there's anyway, so I if you had any thoughts on that. Later on in the chapter, you talk about aggression and competition are linked to fear. Maybe you could expound on that, maybe to help people out there who get nervous before matches, or why those components are there.
Well, yeah, I look at tennis as a fight. It's basically a fight between two individuals, and the elements of a fight come into it. It's a fight where you can't hit the person, but you're doing all the things that you would do in a fight. In other words, you're using your athletic ability and your physicality, your intelligence, your will, your courage. All of the things that you would use in a fight are coming to fore in tennis. And so in a fight, you have elements of aggression. You're trying to get the best of somebody physically and mentally and emotionally and any way you can. So tennis has that potential aggression, and people get angry at their opponents, which is an offshoot of this. You know, I used to get angry when my opponents had control of me on the court. I didn't like it, and I was actually angry at my opponent. So there is potential anger in it. And in any fight, there's an element of fear. In fights, you know, you have aggression and fear both together.
Alan, are you there?
So
I think I lost you.
Tennis as well. I mean, people don't like.
I will try and connect with him.
And they're afraid.
I will try and connect with him again.
You go in. Maybe sometimes you like to fight.
Let's see if I'm able to.
But you're afraid.
Get him out here.
At the same time. Angry and afraid both.
So let me. Go ahead, Alan. You there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Yeah, go ahead.
Go on. Did I leave the scene for a
moment? Yeah, it just cut out. So, but you were talking about the. No, that's right. You're cutting about the anger that does happen and that aspect of the fight.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you're in a fight, they're a combination of aggression and fear. And so you have the same thing in the tennis. I mean, people are afraid of losing tennis matches. You know, they're not sure they're going to win them. And so, yet on the other hand, you want to win and you got to compete. So it's a very difficult sport mentally, more difficult.
I think we lost you again, Alan. Are you back there? Let me just text you. One of the things you talked about there is about the scoring system in tennis, and it's really quite unique. So, Alan, if you come back on there, I'll just I'm going to go ahead and see if I can connect with you, have you call back in. But one of the things